As I welcome everyone to Parshas Vayechi, I have to tell you that I'm excited. I hope you are. Since we started learning the Parsha this year, I have attempted not to learn a new commentator, which I have been doing in the past years, but to really review in my own mind and synthesize many of the commentators and many of the ideas that I have learned, which we've had in this class, to try to really put it together. Vayechi has always been kind of an odd parsha. I have not really understood what its message is. I've been at a loss, the truth is. So this week, in thinking about Vayechi, I had an advantage. I knew that I would have the privilege of going to Rabbi Miller's lecture, who spoke on Wednesday night, and I knew I would listen to him. And I knew that what he would say would be profound, because I know that he is a student of Matthias Weinberg. And last week, we spoke about Rav Matthias Weinberg's explanation of the conflict between Yosef and his brothers, particularly Yosef and Yehuda. So I had a premonition that what I would hear from Rabbi Miller would be the next step, and it was. And not only was it, but I now understand something about the entire Sefer Bereishis that I didn't understand before. And what I'm hoping will happen is that we will synthesize what's going on in the Torah. I mean, these are not separate stories. These are not stories at all. These are developments of the Jewish people. Sefer Bereishis is called Genesis. Genesis means creation. And the entire book is the story of creation. It's not just the first chapter of Bereishit, the 6 days. Then it wouldn't be called the book of creation. It would be called the chapter of creation. The whole book is the book of creation. Creation of what? Creation of the world, the entire world, the spiritual world, the Jewish people and their mission. That's what Genesis means. It's about the creation. Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, they were creating something. They were creating the foundations of living with God, of walking with God as we developed. The 12 tribes were creating something. They were creating the structure for the Jewish people. Yosef and Yehuda were creating. They were creating Malchus, kingship, which, as we described last week, is the synthesis of Klal and Pras, the general with the specific. And Vayechi is the end of the process of creation. I'm going to share with you some of the key ingredients of Rabbi Miller's talk, and then I'm going to add something else which I learned this week, and hopefully you will see why I'm excited. So this is what I heard from Rabbi Miller. The essence is, what I heard from him, is the vitality of the exile experience, the purposefulness of the exile experience. He started off by looking at the Parsha and noting various contradictions about the exile experience versus the redemption experience. The Jewish people, the tribes, the brothers, they found themselves in Mitzrayim, in Egypt. When Yosef went down, that was the beginning of a long sojourn in Egypt, beginning of 210 years. Later, all of the tribes came down. We know that in the beginning of the next book, all the Jewish people are multiplying in Mitzrayim. We also know that Yaakov spent many years in exile. He had to leave the land of Israel and go live with Laban in Chutz La'aretz, outside of the land in the diaspora. So we tend to think of the exile experience as a dark period. It's too bad. Hopefully, one day we'll return. Let's return as fast as we can. That kind of a thing. And Rabbi Miller pointed out that there seems to be somewhat of an expression of appreciation for the exile experience. At the same time, there seem to be indications that we're longing to return. So let me share with you some of those insights from this Parsha, and then we're going to try to explain the dichotomy. As far as the emphasis on the exile experience, we have, first of all, the very beginning of Parshas Vayechi. Vayechi Yaakov be'eretz Mitzrayim, Shiva Esrei Shana. Yaakov lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. And indeed, he spent the rest of his life, he lived out his days out of the land of Israel. And the Zohar looks at the word Vayechi, which means and he lived, and it says, Vayechi Yaakov be'eretz Mitzrayim. Yaakov lived in the land of Mitzrayim. He really lived in Mitzrayim. The Zohar says implying that before he came to Mitzrayim, he wasn't really living. There was something vital. There was a rebirth, a rejuvenation that Yaakov experienced in Mitzrayim. So that's one example. In the second chapter, chapter 48 in the Pasuk, we know that Yaakov has a special moment, encounter, intimate moment with Menashe and Ephraim, who are the two sons of Yosef. He singles them out, gives them their own blessing. He says in verse 5, V'atah shnei vanecha hanoladim lecha be'eretz Mitzrayim, ad bo'i elecha Mitzrayma, lihem. Ephraim u'Menashe, ki Ruvain v'Shimon yihiyu li. And now, your two sons, who were born to you in the land of Egypt, before my coming to you in Egypt, before I had any influence on them, they were natives. They shall be mine. I like them. I like those Egyptian-born grandsons of mine. Ki Ruvain v'Shimon yihiyu li. They will be considered to me like Ruvain and Shimon, like my sons. That's how central these two figures are, Menashe and Ephraim, because they're from Mitzrayim, from the diaspora. There's another emphasis on the exile experience. Right after that, Pasuk Zion, 7th verse, Va'ani bevoi mipadon, meso alai rochel be'eretz knan, baderech, ve'od kivras eretz lavo efrasa, vo'ek bereha sham b'derech efras, hi beis lachem. But as for me, when I came from Padan, when I was returning home from Laban with my wives and my children, Rachel died on me in the land of Canaan on the road, while there was still a stretch of land to go to Ephrat. We didn't make it back to Israel. And guess what? I buried her there on the road to Ephrat, which is Bethlehem. I buried her outside of the land of Israel. The name of Rabbi Miller's lecture was On the Road, or On the Road Again. Rachel, On the Road Again. So Rachel died in the diaspora, and she was buried there. And that is notwithstanding the fact that in the beginning of the Parsha, Yaakov says to Yosef, you know, I'm going to pass away soon. Make sure you bury me in the land of Israel. And yet, he didn't bury Rachel in the land of Israel. So Rashi explains, why didn't Yaakov bury Rachel in the land of Israel? Because Rachel would be on the road that the Jewish people would leave to the exile. If you look on page 271, on footnote 7, about halfway down that paragraph, God commanded Jacob to bury her by the roadside so that she could help the Jewish people through her spiritual influence when Nebuzaradan, the chief general of King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, would lead Israel into captivity after the destruction of the first temple. When the Jews were passing along the road to Bethlehem, tormented, hungry, and exhausted, Rachel's soul came to her grave and wept, beseeching God's mercy upon them. God heard her plea. As the prophet relates, a voice is heard on high, the sound of lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. God replied to her, withhold your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears. Don't cry, for your work will be rewarded, says Hashem, and your children will return to their border. So Rachel is there almost to escort the Jewish people out on the road, out to the diaspora, and stand there vigilantly waiting for their return. And God actually comforts her and says, don't cry, they will return. Rabbi Miller saw from this that Rachel is particularly watchful and hopeful for the Jewish people, not only for their return, but even for their journey away. Again, that pointed to the purposefulness of the exile, which we need to explain. I'm just listing the sources for that. Later, when Yaakov is really on his deathbed, he comes to give the blessing, again, to Menashe and Ephraim. Verse 16, Hamalach ha-goel osi mikol ra, yivorech es-ha-na'arim, v'yikorei bohem shmi, v'shem avosai Avraham v'yitzchak, v'yidgu la-rov v'kerev ha-aretz. May the angel who redeems me from all evil bless the lads, and may my name be declared upon them and the names of my forefathers. May they proliferate abundantly like fish within the land. My blessing to Menashe and Ephraim, again, singling out Menashe and Ephraim, who live in Mitzrayim, is that they should be abundant. They should multiply. They should fill up the world. They should be, in Rabbi Miller's words, very productive in the exile. What's the idea of productive? Why do they have to be productive in the exile? We'd rather be productive in the land of Israel. Let's give the blessing of productivity to the other ones. You know, if somebody goes into exile, you don't say to them, I hope you're very productive there. You say, I hope that you're safe there. In fact, the human reaction is that when you are in a state of danger, you don't try to be productive. In fact, we'll talk about this next time. You know, the men didn't want to have children in Egypt. They said, what, we're going to bring children into this hell? And the women said, no, we have to have children. Again, why be productive when it's such a depressed time? Why should the people who symbolize the exile be blessed with productivity, progress? Again, another indication that there's something purposeful and something vital about the exile experience. And finally, I would like to throw in just a historical observation. Jewish history. Where have we spent more time? In the redemptive state, in Israel, with the temple, or in exile? Certainly within exile. Our experiences of the highlight of the pinnacle of Jewish living was very scarce, relatively speaking. From Sinai, we went through the desert. Even that was a form of exile, 40 years wandering. And then we came to the land of Israel. By the time everything was set up, King Solomon built the temple, 410 years. And then exile for 70. Back to Israel, next temple, 420 years. And then back to exile for 2,000 years, you know, the ideal state seems to be the minority. So look at Jewish history. Is all this time that we're spending in the exile just a sad, unfortunate situation that we have to bear until we can live again? So these are things to think about. Golus is not just an aberration. Exile, seems to be something significant in our lives. On the other hand, we see the emphasis on the geula, the emphasis on the redemption. As we mentioned already, Yaakov said to Yosef, don't bury me in Mitzrayim, even though I'm going to die here, bury me in the land of Israel. Even Menashe and Ephraim, with all of the prominence that Yaakov gives them, in the final analysis, they're not the big hitters of the tribes. It was not Menashe and Ephraim that produced the kings. That was Yehuda. Yehuda produced the kings, not the children of Yosef. It was Levi that became the priests and the Levites. So Menashe and Ephraim, so much prominence that they are given in Vayechi, they don't seem to be, in the ultimate sense, the big leaders. Even Rachel, you may say that she's accompanying them into Golus. She's watchful, she's vigilant. But really what she wants for them is to return. What really seems to be of greater significance would be the blessings that Yaakov bestows upon all of his children. Chapter 49 in the Parsha, where he attends to all of them. And he says, Jacob called for his sons and said, assemble yourselves, and I will tell you what will befall you in the end of days. We're really looking for the end. We're really looking to get beyond the here and now and get to the end of days. So I hope that I'm conveying this. There's a sense of conflict about, on one hand, the seeming prominence and position of the exile experience, the fact that it is the majority of the time in our history, the fact that Menashe and Ephraim are given prominence, and, of course, I forgot to mention, when we bless our children, we bless them to be like Menashe and Ephraim. Isn't that a little strange? Why them? Why not Levi? Why not Yehuda? Why Menashe and Ephraim? There seems to be a prominence to that. On the other hand, we cannot deny the fact that we're always looking forward to redemption. So Rabbi Miller concluded that both are important, that Golus is vital too. But what I would like to add to that is a perspective on why it's so vital. Another source, which I'll mention that we've talked about in our class, is the explanation that Rabbi Dessler in Michtav Ne'Eliyahu gave us on the purpose of the exile. You know, the exile is synonymous with the four powerful governments that ruled and subjugated us, not even including Egypt. I mean, Egypt was like the prototype of all exiles. So we know how important, how prevailing the Egyptian culture was upon us. That we know. But then there were the other four, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans. And Rav Dessler says there's a purpose to all that, because we have to perfect ourselves. There's a lot of evil in the world, and there's evil inside of us too. There are imperfections in our character, in the way that we relate to our bodies, pursuing material pleasure. There are imperfections in the way we relate to our character traits, such as our midos, or a sense of anger, or a sense of haughtiness, arrogance, or a sense of possessiveness, as opposed to kindness and forbearance and mercy. There are imperfections in the development of our minds, in terms of knowing what is true and what is not true, what is the important knowledge to have, and what is the unimportant knowledge. And there are also imperfections in our relationship to the Spirit, to God, and to spiritual matters. These are the various levels of our personalities, and we really have to perfect them. So what these four governing powers are powers which excelled in the destructiveness of these four areas. There was a power that excelled in hedonism, the Persians. Could you imagine having a party for 6 months? Can you imagine the hangover? We have the Babylonians who excelled in arrogance, in conquest. We have the Greeks who excelled in self-humanistic thinking, in which man developed his mind, but man was the master of all knowledge, not leaving room for a higher form of knowledge. If it's not rational, if it can't be proven, then it's not true. That's a problem in the mind. And then the Romans seem to have a problem with religion, trying to persecute and stamp out our belief in God, similar to their ancestor Esav, who was just the antithesis of Yaakov. And says Rav Dessler, when we are encountered by this force that exhibits such a destructive power in these areas, it forces us, well, first of all, it influences us, but it pushes us so far to the other side that we stop and we say, this can't be. This isn't the way it's supposed to be. And this actually makes us fight against it. So that we start to go away from their ways. We start to perfect the purity of the body and of the character traits and of the mind and of the spirit. And the purpose of the exile, says Rav Dessler, I likened it to like a vaccination. If you want to develop an antibody, an immunity to some toxin, what you do is you introduce a little bit of that toxin to the body, and that causes the body to say, hey, there's a foreign substance in my body, I've got to fight against it. So this is Rav Dessler's explanation of the exile, and it deserves a class in and of its own. But we had a class on this, but we're trying to synthesize here. So I'm going to take what Rav Dessler says, but I'm still going to go further and ask, why is it that we don't see the gullus as purposeful? We see the gullus as unfortunate, as an obstacle. I wish, let's just close our eyes and say, we want Mashiach now. Get me out of here. Click our heels together. There's no place like home. There's no place like home. Is that really our approach to the gullus? Or is there something purposeful? Is there something vital? Is there something exciting, perhaps? So here was the missing link. And now I'm going to share with you something that I learned, which tied it together. And that is from another great thinking rabbi of our contemporary times, Rabbi Akiva Tatz. From London. I've quoted him before. I'm probably going to quote him more and more. There's a wonderful book called The Thinking Jewish Teenager's Guide to Life by Akiva Tatz. Don't waste your time trying to get a teenager to read it, because I doubt a teenager will, unless they're some kind of a Rhodes Scholar, I don't think they'll grasp it. But this is great reading for an adult. Chapter 7 is called Getting High, Staying High. Listen to what he says. He's writing it for teenagers, but a teenager won't understand it. I shouldn't generalize. He talks about the phenomenon that we find in life, that the good times never last. We are used to life being a series of ups and downs. We love the ups. We love getting something new, a new experience, a new relationship. We seem to be so motivated, so thrilled, so enthused when new things come about. And yet, how often do we find it that after time, the excitement wears off and we find ourselves bored, dulled, and looking for the next thrill? He says that this is one of the great secrets of life. He says that this is rooted in the Torah. This is at the root of the Egypt experience, where the Jewish people went from high to low. But then God made a massive revelation through the 10 plagues. The Jewish people were awestruck and just totally blown away by the display of God's might. And we felt like we were just being lifted. We were just spectators at this fantastic show. And it was all for us. And we watched God as he dazzled the world. And if that wasn't enough, he took us out of Egypt and he brought us to the sea. And we watched the second part of the double feature, the splitting of the Red Sea. And that was even more. And we were lifted, we were catapulted to new levels of belief and faith in God. As we say in the prayers, they saw God's hand, they believed in God and Moshe's servant. We were being carried on cloud nine. And then, what happened the day after? Read Parshas Bishalach. And the Jews found themselves in a desert. And there was no water, and there was no food, and it was hot. No life, barren, boring, dull. What happened to the light and sound show? So, they started to walk, they started to travel. 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Where were they going? Where are we going to get there? Where are we going? We know what happened 7 weeks later. Somehow, little by little, maybe subconsciously, the Jewish people started to learn. They started to learn about God. They started to learn that if you may seem like there's no support, but really God is supporting us. And they started to learn. They started to learn about God, not to complain. What happens if you complain about things? It's not good. They were learning. And in 7 weeks' time, lo and behold, they found themselves at the foot of Mount Sinai. And guess what? A new light show, the giving of the Torah. But this time, they understood there was something sweeter. There was something more exciting about that than even what they experienced in Mitzrayim. Why? What's the difference between the excitement of Mitzrayim and the excitement of giving of the Torah? What was the difference? So Rabbi Katz explains it with a very, very simple, common, well-known example. Learning to walk. I'm going to read a few paragraphs. Perhaps the best analogy is a father teaching his child to walk. Could be a mother. First, the father supports the child and lifts him gently to his feet. As he holds the child's hands and the child takes his first ecstatic step, he is filled with a sense of power and exhilaration. In his young, inexperienced mind, he is walking, and he cannot fall. His father is holding him. But then the father must let go. There is no other way to learn. The child must take a frightened and lonely step, unaided. And at the moment when he finds himself unsupported, he feels a cruel stab of pain and fear. The one he trusted has let go. He has been lured into this situation of danger, and now he must manage on his own. Have I been abandoned? That's my own words. He is forced to take the next step alone. But it is only then that he learns to walk. Then and only then, when he is walking independently, can he feel his father's love. In the very moment which previously felt like desertion, only then does he realize that in the moment that felt like desertion was a greater love than in the moment of support. The moment of his father's letting go and allowing him to stand on his own was a far more profound moment of love than any other. And only then can he rush into his father's arms in real understanding. First, it was necessary to hold and lift him. He would not have learned otherwise. He wouldn't have known what walking is, right? First, he had to be shown. But then, when the lesson has been taught, he has to be left on his own. And that is where he learned to walk. That is the secret of life. First, it is done for you. Then you must do it yourself. The child in you must be nurtured and suckled, but when it is time to become an adult, you must fight for yourself. Unfortunately, says Rabbi Tatz, most people do not know this secret. We think that the world is supposed to be a constant thrill, and we feel only half alive because it is not. We crave the moments of uplift, the free rides, and we dread the moments of seeming abandonment and letdown. And if you do not understand that you are never abandoned, your life can be a living hell of fear and pain. But if you realize that in every moment of difficulty, every moment of independent struggle, you are learning to walk, your hands are just out of contact with his, and he is waiting for that embrace. As you walk and then run independently, Life can be a process of maintained inspiration despite its ordeals? No. Because of its ordeals. That's the secret. That is the secret. And that is the synthesis. And that is the reason that Galus is so important, that the exile is so prominent, that we have to spend more time in exile than we spend in the moments of glory. Because the moments of glory is the free ride. It's when God is lifting us up, not with our own merit, but just to give us a glimpse of what we have the potential for. The difference between the exhilaration in Egypt and at the sea and the exhilaration of Har Sinai was, now do we see the difference? Do we see the difference now? If I ask you the question again, what's the answer?
What's the question?
What was the difference between the sense of excitement and exhilaration in Egypt when we saw the plagues and we saw the splitting of the sea and the sense of exhilaration as we stood at Mount Sinai? What was the difference? If you don't know the answer, then I haven't explained what I'm trying to say.
God was carrying us, and then He let us go.
And then, and during...
He gave us these laws to live by, and we were given everything that we were supposed to be given, and we have the equipment, and now we're on our own to cultivate this to the best that we can.
Okay, but even before we got the Torah, there were 7 weeks. See, the way it was is we left Egypt on Pesach, and the splitting of the sea was, let's say, the 7th day of Pesach. Then there's the days in between. We mark them by counting the Omer. The 7 weeks. We don't have the Torah yet. But those are days of wandering through the desert without food, without water. Well, initially without food, without water. And then we learn how to live with God. And we learn how to ask for it. And we learn how to receive. And we learn how to be satisfied with a portion of food. Because tomorrow, He'll give us another portion. That's where we learned how to walk on our own feet. When we stood at the mountain, God says, you have raised yourselves over these 7 weeks. This is exhilarating because this time I'm giving you what you earned, what you deserved. In Mitzrayim, I was showing you how great I was before you had taken any steps. I was holding your hand. That's like the time when the parent is holding the child and he's walking. That was in Mitzrayim. At Har Sinai, it's when we were walking on our own and we turned to God and we embraced Him and He says, you guided us to be able to stand before you and be willing to accept your Torah. Because now we can do that on our own. We struggled. It was boring. We went through the desert. We didn't have the food. We didn't have the water. We had to learn how to live with you. That's more exhilarating. That pattern is going to be repeated again and again. There are going to be moments where God lifts us up and then He's going to let go. You know why the golden calf happened? Because even with the fact that we earned it, God still gave us a free ride at Mount Sinai. He still, after everything, we had spent 7 weeks, we had taken a few steps, we weren't really proficient yet. So when God gave us the Torah, it was still raising us above our level. Maybe to the level of our potential, but not to where we were actually capable on our own. So it was almost predictable that after getting the Torah on Har Sinai, there was going to be another drop. And then we have to work to climb up again. That pattern is repeated again and again. And when we have the temple in Jerusalem, we're lifted up again. But it's almost predictable that we're going to fall. But that's okay, because that just means that now we have to do our homework. And every single galus, every single exile was a period, a long period for us to do our homework. And that's what Rabbi Dessler was talking about. When we lived in Mitzrayim, we had to learn how to keep our languages and our names. It was a little bit, but it was something. When we went into Babylonia, we had to learn how to fight against dictatorship and arrogance and all of the negative influences of the Babylonians. We had to purify our soul. When we went into Persia, we had to purify our bodies and stop living like hedonists, like the Persians. When we had to be subjugated by the Greeks, we had to learn how to purify our minds. Those are all the periods of doing the work on our own. And Rachel knew that. Rachel was waiting there. She's saying, I'm going to watch. I'm going to stand here. I'm going to pray for your return, but you've got to go there. This is for your own good. And I know you're going to come back. There's a purpose to why you're going. You're going there so you can come back. So to what degree does this explain the long-term survival of the Jewish people? Well, what explains that is that God never abandoned us. He, from the moment that he met Abraham, he told him, your children are going to become a great nation and they're going to survive until the end of time. And unlike the people who would think that when we were put into exile, we were rejected, we weren't rejected. God was just letting go of our hand so that we could walk. And all of the great achievements in the spirit of the Jewish people, in the mind of the Jewish people, in the character of the Jewish people, were achieved during the darkness of the exile. And that was part of God's plan. And if he hadn't put us into exile, then we would never have learned how to walk. And that means that when we wake up in the morning, we have to maybe utter a prayer for the speedy salvation, the speedy return, and the coming of the Mashiach, and the next revelation. We'll make that prayer, but then we will pray, God, please enable us to have a vital life here in Mitzrayim. Vayechi Yaakov be'eretz Mitzrayim. Yaakov lived every day in Mitzrayim with a purpose. Yosef was productive. We had children. We educated our children. We built our community. We pray to God to help us live life to the fullest in the exile. Whenever you take us home, you know when it's time for that. In the meantime, we're going to practice walking. And we're going to build up our potential, our abilities, because they still lay dormant. They're potential, but we have to actualize them. And that is the vital purpose of the exile. I don't want to take any more time, but this is really the theme of the story of Bereishis. It all goes back to Adam and the tree. Because when Adam was in the Garden of Eden, that was a free ride. And Adam looked at the situation and he said, you know, there's something missing here. I'm not doing anything. I'm not developing. So he made the mistake of eating from the tree. But what that did was, he took the step, I've got to do it myself. Like the child says, you know, if you get a very rambunctious child, they might say to the father, let me do it myself. He might even say, let go of me. I want to fall. That's kind of what Adam did. So the rest of the journey is to learn how to walk. And we had the Avos, we had Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, who took their own personal journeys, and they learned how to walk, and that provided for us that beacon of light of how it's supposed to be. But then came the children, the 12 tribes, and they had to figure it out on their own. They had to learn how to live together. They had to go through the challenge of relationships, of differences, and how to reconcile. What approach should we take? How should we go about this life? And that's the pathway for the children. We're always going to have Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov to look towards, but we have to put in the time and the effort, each one of us individually and collectively, klal, to learn how to walk like our patriarchs and our matriarchs did before us. It's vital. It's purposeful. That is why we're here. And at the end of the Sefer Bereishis, we now have a complete understanding what is being created here. What's being created here is a world in which we are shown the light, where we see with a flash what the possibility is, what the goal is, what the attainment is, and then we're also taught by the story of Bereishis on how to get there by walking on our own 2 feet. That is the complete story of the Genesis. Sure. That's my understanding. Thank you.
Sure. Very good.